The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'll open us in prayer and then we'll talk. So, let's pray. Heavenly Father, fountain of all wisdom, enlightened by the Holy Spirit, those who teach and those who learn, so that rejoicing always in your truth, we may worship and serve you from generation to generation. Through Jesus Christ, your only Son, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. All right, I'm going to open with a promise and a threat. They're one and the same. Before you leave here today, I'm going to make you do math. But it's going to be okay. You're actually going to do some math today, but I promise it's going to be okay. First, though, I'd like to get to know you all a little bit. Show of hands, how many of you all have at some point in the last couple of months read a book for pleasure? Okay, a lot of hands. Question two, how many of you have, sort of recently gotten together with some of your friends to talk about a book that you've read, right? How many of you all have had a conversation with friends about, okay, also, a pretty widespread thing. How many of you have either sung or listened to a piece of music for pleasure? Nice. Possibly today. Do any of you all get together with your friends and make music for pleasure, like sing in a choir or something like that? Fewer, but still a decent chunk of people. How many of you have gotten together with your friends recently and sat down to do math for pleasure? My people, we should talk. That's awesome. That's pretty fantastic. How many of you have students who regularly get together with their friends to do math for pleasure? Okay. So one or two. Okay, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Look at the difference, though, between how many people raise their hands about books, about music, and about math. That's odd, right? And in fact, the question, how many of you get together with your friends to do math for pleasure, seems kind of like a weird question. Like, that's not part of our conceptual vocabulary. Why? Why is that? Well, it's because of how we've been taught to think about doing math, right? By and large, by our own education, we've been taught to think about doing math in a way that's very different from how we think about listening to music or making music. When we teach our subjects, there's at least two things going on in the classroom. One of them is we're teaching our subject, but we're also teaching our students what it means to be a student of that subject, right? So when a history teacher has his students read Herodotus, right, he's teaching them what it means to be a historian. A historian's the sort of person who reads Herodotus. By selecting Herodotus and not selecting, say, a long list of facts and figures about troop sizes in the Persian Wars, right, they're communicating something about what it means to be a student of history. Similarly, when a literature teacher assigns their students an essay exam, right, they're communicating something about what it means to be a reader, what it means to be a student of literature. How different a thing they would communicate if they said, I'm going to test you on your literature with multiple choice, right? That communicates something different about what it means to study literature. When a math teacher assigns problems 1 through 30 odd in the back of the textbook for homework, we as math teachers are making a very definite, though I suspect unconscious, claim about what it means to be a mathematician and what it means to study math. We often carefully consider our curricular choices in terms of the material itself, right? So what are the best books to read in 10th grade? What mathematical concepts do our students need to have before they take the SAT or the CLT? What should we discuss, dissect in the biology lab, right? Well, you think about these for our students. How often do we think of our curricular choices in terms of how they form the students to think about the material itself? Probably less than we should. Something a little bit like what Krish Lecht said about the tectonic plates of the classroom, right? There's something going on in the foundation that's important that I think we're often not conscious of. Okay, so this talk's going to be roughly in two parts. The first part's going to be really grim, and then the second part's going to be hopeful. So we're going to start with the grim part, and then we'll get to the hopeful part. So what does the shape of a modern math class teach students culturally about being a mathematician? Here, I'm going to lean on Paul Lockhart's really excellent essay, A Mathematician's Lament. If you haven't read A Mathematician's Lament, you should, like, take out your phone and don't do that. Wait until I'm done and then take out your phone and immediately read it. It's about a half-hour read. It's spectacular. It'll cut you to the quick if you haven't read it. He describes an imaginary music class like this. Okay, so a student says, music class is where we take out our staff paper, our teacher puts some notes on the board, and we copy or transpose them into a different key. We have to make sure to get the clefs and key signatures right, and our teacher's very, very picky about making sure we fill in our quarter notes completely. One time we had a chromatic scale problem, and I did it right, but the teacher gave me no credit because I had the stems pointing the wrong way. All right, music teachers would listen to that and shudder in horror, right? That's not what music is about. Lockhart's contention, and I think he's correct about this, is that actually we teach math in an analogous way. The modern math curriculum is almost designed to suck whatever mathematical soul children have right out of them and replace it with something like dead and burned out. I don't think we do this on purpose. I think it's accidental, but I think it's there. So first I want to describe three features of sort of a modern math classroom that are profoundly inhumane and teach students that mathematics is actively opposed to the good, true, and beautiful. I think certainly for a lot of my career, I was doing this by accident. So first, a modern math classroom is Sisyphean. All right, so numbers 1 through 30, odd for homework tonight, please. One lesson a day, moving through the chapters of the book. Each chapter is of equal importance. Each section is of equal importance. What does that cultural practice of math homework teach students about being a mathematician? Nothing good. Foremost, it teaches them that mathematicians are terribly busy and have to be ruthlessly efficient. Good mathematicians can tackle upwards of 30 semi-related problems per hour. Good mathematicians spend as much time on scientific notation as they spend on the idea of the infinitude of primes. And truth be told, if we're honest about most of our curricula, the infinitude of primes might not make it at all. They spend as much time on graphing quadratic inequalities as on the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. All topics are equally important and worth the same time and energy. Good mathematicians can internalize any particular topic in one night. Maybe two if it's a really hard topic, right? You might get 2 days on a section for something really hard. There's so much material to cover that contemplation has to go by the wayside in a quest to make it to the end of the book before the year runs out. Often, the only thing that matters to a good mathematician is completing problems. That is, writing down some collection of mathematical symbols, and then at the end of those mathematical symbols, writing the answer from the back of the book. If teachers aren't attentive, they might not notice that the work is just nonsense. Certainly, I've had students try and pull this one on me, and sometimes I've caught it, and sometimes I haven't. But the work is completed, and therefore, it gets the good completion grade. What does that teach students about mathematics? Of course, sometimes the teacher might, being dutiful, try and read all of the students' little mathematical arguments. For a normal-sized class, that might mean 200 little mathematical arguments in a night. Whew. If math students are busy, math teachers are even busier, right? Worst of all, I think that cultural practice teaches students that the reward of successfully completing mathematical tasks is, well, worse mathematical tasks. Once you finish tonight's homework, there will be tomorrow's. The only difference is that tomorrow's is probably going to be a little more difficult. So like Sisyphus, the students sort of roll this weighty boulder of their homework up the hill every night, only to have it roll down the next day. Some curricula make the Sisyphean progression overt, right? You do this type of problem in a section, you roll the boulder up the hill, it rolls back down, maybe you do it once again at the end of the chapter, and then gone into the mist of time, never to appear again. Other curricula sort of spiral them so that the boulder reappears a couple of times, but is a little bigger each time it reappears, in an attempt, I guess, to conceal the suit. Look, no one, how many of you all sit down with a math textbook and routinely rip out 30 or 40 problems for fun? No one could confuse that for a picture of the good life, right? You just couldn't. So that's one thing that I think we do, that we should think about. So the second thing is that they have invaded our classrooms and taken over the classroom culture. By they, my students say this, what do they want me to do, right? What do the students mean? Well, they mean the authors of the textbook, right? Who are A, not present in the room, B, certainly faceless, and C, maybe even nameless, right? And yet they're the disproportionate cultural force in a math classroom. What does that say about the mathematical community? And truth be told, often the authors of math textbooks are not themselves eminent mathematicians. Well, I'll talk more about that later. Okay, they should be. It teaches students that what counts, what your aim, your goal in math class, is to satisfy the authority of these nameless and faceless people. Not to convince yourself, not to convince your peers, but to satisfy this distant external authority. What does that teach them about what it means to do math? What would that even look like in a literature class? I can't even imagine what that would look like. It's something isolating, though. Imagine, for a minute, a literature textbook featured, right? So it gives you sort of a chapter of Pride and Prejudice, in passing, without the rest of the book, and then a bunch of questions about Pride and Prejudice, interpretive questions. Do you think that Wickham and Lydia are a good match? And you flip to the back of the book, and it says, no. You all laugh at that, right? There's something ridiculous about that idea, right? Because we recognize that, well, that's not really an answer to that question. But, right, here's this equation, solve it, flip to the back of the book, x is 7. Is that different, right? That should be ridiculous to us, too. Because of all disciplines, mathematics is perhaps the least interested in arguments by authority. We're interested in Euclid not because he's Euclid, but because he proves the things he says. And yet, the way we teach our textbooks, we're training the kids that fundamentally math is about deference to this weird impersonal authority off in the distance. Okay, and so when I used textbooks that did this before I stopped doing that, there was always this moment of like abject panic and terror from my students when they would have done the homework and done it well and done it diligently and gotten something different from the back of the book. And they would come in with this sort of existential terror of like, oh no, I'm bad at math. And in reality, of course, what's happened? The textbook authors, being sort of people under a time crunch, have made a typo or put the wrong answer down or something like that, and the student's right. They have no avenue, they have no venue to argue with the textbook, right? They can't say, look, I think my reasons are good, and here's why, and have the textbook say, oh gosh, I'm persuaded, you're correct, and my answer's wrong. So again, there's this impersonal authority that really destroys the dynamic of mathematical community in the classroom. What does that teach them about mathematics? In passing, even the distinction we draw between answers and work, I think, teaches the students something unhealthy about mathematical community. Imagine a student in a history class who this teacher assigns sort of, write me an essay about Napoleon, was he a good leader for France? And the student raises their hand and says, do I need to show my work? Or can I just write yes? Right, again, there's something really ridiculous about that, because in history, we rightly recognize that the arguments leading us to a conclusion and the conclusion are inseparable, right? If you just drop a conclusion with no arguments supporting it, that's valueless in history. And yet in math, even if we do say, look, show me the work, the students have this conceptual distinction where the answer is something different and sort of magical and disconnected from the chain of reasoning that supports it. What does that teach students about math? Okay, so Sisyphean, weirdly authoritarian, and the third one is the one that struck me first. One of my favorite problems in our pre-calculus text involved submarines. Thinking like, aha, here's something that the kids will get into. It's okay, so you've got a submarine, and it tells you the angle and distance of a sonar return, and you're supposed to do trigonometry at that to figure out how deep the other submarine is. Like, okay, this is a good application problem. Submarines, the kids will be into it. So we work it through, and the textbook dutifully confirms that the depth of the second submarine is about 900 meters. I'm getting ready to teach this, and I'm like, I should find out about submarines. So I look at the submarines, and I'm like, yeah, this is submarines. Go to the Wikipedia, sort of noodle through the submarines, and decide, like, okay, I'm pretty sure they've drawn Virginia-class attack submarines in the book. Like, that's what this is a picture of. So I look up the Virginia-class attack submarine. Like, aha. So it's crush depth. So the crush depth is the depth where, like, if you take a submarine this deep, the water crushes it and everyone dies. The crush depth of a Virginia-class attack submarine is, I said, between 450 and 500 meters. So alas for the crew of our dead submarine. There are a bunch of other fun ones like that. Another one I love is in our Algebra 2 textbook, there was a question that asked students to calculate the height of an armadillo's jump by solving a quadratic, like finding the vertex of a quadratic to calculate how high an armadillo jumped. And the answer ended up being something like 6.5 feet. Another favorite of mine is an attempt to make, oh gosh, this one my students and I actually made fun of in class. It was an attempt to make linear inequalities relevant. It was at the beginning of a chapter, like, linear inequalities, here's why they're great. When you apply for your job as a bowling pin manufacturing quality control inspector, you will use linear inequalities to determine if the bowling pins are made to tolerance. So the argument I'm making to my students there is if you want to work as a bowling pin quality control inspector, then you should learn linear inequalities. Well, I don't. I mean, how many of those can there be? Five? Like, there's just not that many of them. I don't want to do that, so I guess I shouldn't learn linear inequalities. And I think that's the fundamental difficulty with those sorts of questions, is that the hypothetical scenarios are deeply unreal, which is problematic because I think, well, okay, so look, I think this is kind of kabuki theater. Unless our students are real doorknobs, they can look at that and be like, really, man, come on. And we as teachers then have to choose either, like, I will protect the shield and pretend that this is relevant, or join our students in saying, like, yeah, that's pretty dumb. Oh gosh, what does that teach them about math, right? The fact that we as teachers have to go through this bizarre kabuki dance, what is that telling our students about what mathematicians think about truth? Okay. In passing, I think this dynamic in our texts and in our culture is driven by the Scylla and Charybdis of insecurity on the one hand and consumerism on the other. Our society has decided in the wake of Sputnik that math is useful, and therefore the way we teach math has to be useful in the sense of helping us nuke the Soviets. And as a consequence, we have to rush through a lot of math that leads you towards building rockets. I think that's the driving force in this. That's the insecurity, and the consumerism is we've decided that if you're going to teach something, you have to be able to immediately tell your students why it's valuable to them. We can't say, look, hang back, trust me for 6 months, and I promise this will be valuable on the back end. So I think those have led us to this sort of bizarre place where the math we teach is deeply untrue. And oh gosh, that's a weird thing to say about math. In Double Passing, the linguistic shift from story problem to word problem is really interesting. So take a minute sometime and think about the difference between those two. What's the difference between a story problem and a word problem? Okay, I've painted like the grimmest possible picture of the math classroom. This is a math classroom that actively destroys students' love of mathematics, that makes them think that mathematics is this isolating authoritarian pursuit, and that makes them think that mathematicians care little for the truth of things. And I'll confess, when I started teaching math, that was pretty much my classroom. I didn't know any better. That's the math that I was raised on. But my school has been working on a project. It's we're 5 years in, and I think we've got a lot more years to go on this, to essentially say, well, what if it doesn't have to be like that? Can we do it differently? So what I want to spend the back half of my talk telling you guys is kind of here's how what we've done and here's how it's gone. All right. If I had to boil it down to one thought, here's the one thought I would boil it down to. All the good stuff we say about pedagogy in the humanities, right? In classical Christian education, we tend to say, like, discussion is really valuable in the classroom, except in math, right? You need to have good, written, formative feedback, except in math. Stop saying that. Just stop saying except in math. All of the ideas that are good, sound, classical, liberal pedagogy in the humanities are good, sound, classical, liberal pedagogy in math, too. Math is really one of the liberal arts and one of the humanities along with its peers, and you can teach it that way, and it's really cool when you do. Okay, so I think, too, as Christians, the idea that we can emphasize a profound unity in the way we think about our intellectual pursuits is valuable, too, and one that we often miss. So nuts and bolts time. I do what I'm about to describe like 15 times in pre-calculus in a year and maybe 10 times in algebra 2. You could talk me into making both of those numbers go up by 3 or 4. I wouldn't want to do it 50 times. When I started, we did it once or twice a year because it's terrifying and I didn't know what I was doing. So here's the ideal rhythm of a discussion week in my classroom. On Monday, I give the students a novel and difficult problem that I have not taught them how to solve, and I let them work on it. Usually very little forward motion is made. Often they get to a point where by the end of Monday, they sort of understand what the question is asking. Tuesday, 45 minutes of class, they work the problem together in a group. Usually on Tuesday, they see some promising avenue of attack. Often it ultimately is unsuccessful and just fails. I'm fine with that. On Wednesday, usually by Wednesday, sometimes Thursday, they have a promising avenue of attack that looks like it's going to succeed, and they're running it to ground. They're starting to formulate an answer that they think is going to work and be a keeper. At that point, I tell them when their paper's due. I don't usually tell them when the paper's due until I'm convinced that they're on a track that will lead them to an answer. And then the next couple of days, I spend introducing them to new grammatical material, new notation, new techniques. I do a lot of that inductively. And the hope is that as we play with that for a couple of days, well, maybe, depending on how I've arranged things, a new, novel, and difficult problem will appear that they haven't learned how to solve. And then we wash, rinse, and repeat. So that's the central organizing dynamic of my math classroom. We don't do it every week, but we do a lot of it. And I do this with 10th and 11th graders. Okay, there are a few parts of that weekly liturgy that would have terrified me when I was a young math teacher, and still kind of do sometimes. Okay, you let your students work on a single problem for 45 straight minutes. Yep, you gotta pick the right problem. You spend a whole day letting them work on something that you know is not going to succeed. I do. Seldom does it go more than 20 minutes before they realize that what they're doing is not going to work. But I've definitely had classes put 45 minutes into an approach only to realize at the end that they had done something silly at the beginning, and I just let them run with it. And then when they realize, like, ooh, like that didn't work, it sinks in a way that it wouldn't if I just cut them off after 2 minutes of it and said, like, FYI, this isn't going to work. I want them to feel the, well, and it's a normal part of math, right? As a grown-up, we go into things not knowing exactly how they're going to work out for us. We've got to try and see what happens. Okay, how do you plan your lessons if you really don't have a keen sense of how long things are going to take? Thank you, Dean. My administrator is very gracious. I plan flexibly. Sometimes problems are going to take a class a little longer. And what that means is maybe we shortchange finding slant asymptotes of rational functions. Maybe we shortchange really talking through the end state behavior of functions in great detail. I'm okay with that trade-off. I'm okay to cover less material in order to have this students to have the sort of transcendent experience of really wrestling with hard questions and coming to their own answers. I think it's a price that's well worth paying. Eventually, like, you could go too far with that, but I think we're nowhere near that as a culture. Wait, you assign papers? I do. I assign papers to the students, and I grade them as if I were a humanities teacher. Okay. What do you do while the students are working on these problems? I mean, it seems like what... Okay, so you set students on one problem for 45 minutes. Do you just sit there? Yes, if I can get away with it. Like, my ideal math class, I would just kind of sit in the corner. And the students would be mathematicians. We're not there yet, right? Because they're young and they're growing as mathematicians. But that's not a catastrophe. I will say, though, that I think there's a real role for imitation in the math classroom. So I do think that there's a role for a teacher talking through, here's how I would tackle this problem, so that the students have something to imitate. I do that more than it sounds like from my talk. In a good math class, I'll say 6 or 7 pretty carefully chosen sentences. You got to pick your moments. Usually I'll frown a couple of times. The students have really become connoisseurs of my facial expression, which means that I often have to work really hard to conceal from them what I think about the work that they're... Like, if I know something's not going to work, I have to be very impassive. Or they'll figure out, like, oh, no, Mr. Carey thinks this isn't going to work. Those are my good days. On my bad days in the classroom, I ruin the whole thing by giving the students too much help and taking away from them the essential work of doing the problem. Okay, so I often have to leave the classroom. If my students find this very funny, like, I'll just run out into the hallway in the middle of class. They'll be close to something, and I'll be like, ah, like, you're close and you don't see it. I want to help you. And I'm worried that I can't help them. I don't want to help them. It's bad for them if I help them. So I don't want to help, but I can't control it, so I have to leave. And they now find that sort of amusing. Okay, all well and good, you might say, but it appears that you have super genius, never misbehaved children who will do math consecutively for 45 minutes without ever doing anything bad. I don't. I have pretty normal kids. Sometimes they do bad things, but actually a lot less often than you would think. If you build a culture where the cultural expectation is that you will think about math for 45 minutes, the kids will totally do it. It's tricky, and you have to be careful, and you have to build that culture. Okay. So how do we actually do this? The first pillar is you have to have good texts, right? If you were going to teach a literature class and you said, ha-ha, we now begin our unit on the Hardy Boys with 11th graders, like, it's all over, you're done. So you have to have good texts. In the humanities, that means putting the students face-to-face with something powerful and outside of themselves. The great texts of our shared intellectual heritage, and then you let those go to work on the student. That's what you do in the humanities, and it's the exact same thing in a math class. You find great texts, and you let them work on the students. Okay, fine. What are those texts? Most of them are just good problems. Good, hard, interesting problems that have legs and that the students can work on. Some of them are actual texts where I give the students both the problem and its solution, and we just read it through together and talk about it and try and understand how some great mathematician has wrestled with something. Good problems have to ride a razor's edge. They can't be something that students are going to get in 3 minutes. They also can't be something that's going to take the kids 6 weeks to get through. I've definitely made both of those mistakes. It's really awkward when you have a lesson plan that's worked for this problem for 45 minutes, and 3.5 minutes into it, the kids are done with the problem. Like, ugh. It's also rough when you're on day 4 and you're like, oh man, this is going nowhere. And usually at that point, I just pull the ripcord and say, like, well, that was a bad problem. My fault. Sorry, guys. We're going to move on to something else. I'll figure out a way to come back to that. Ideally good problems, to steal a word from, I think, Andrew Smith. He said that teachers should be unbusy, subversive, and apocalyptic. I think that good math problems should be apocalyptic in the sense that they should reveal some beautiful pattern or some deeper truth. That's what you're aiming at. Okay, so what do those look like? I begin every pre-calculus class with the same problem. I've stolen it from George Polya's masterful book, How to Solve It. If you haven't read Polya's How to Solve It, again, that's one where like that should jump to the top of your reading list. It really shaped the way I work in my math classroom. And his problem's this. You've got a rectangular prism. Imagine we've got one of these projectors. How long is the distance from sort of this bottom corner across to this top corner over here? It's concrete. I can say the question in one sentence. It's probably not something that my pre-calculus students have ever thought about very much before. It builds naturally on something very familiar, the Pythagorean theorem, and builds to something sort of interesting, solid geometry. It offers the kids an opportunity to think physically. Most of my classes will go locate some sort of box and some sort of ruler and start messing around with them. That leads to a great discussion about, can you answer a math question with a ruler? And there's always good conversation about that. The answer is really surprising at first to the students, and then when they reflect on it, it seems necessary and obvious. They get there and they're like, it can't be that. And then 20 minutes later, they're like, obviously it has to be that. It affords a nice opportunity to talk about what does it mean to check your work in math. Most of them come in thinking that checking your work in math just means doing the exact same thing you did again. And it's hard to break them of that habit. Sharp classes will get that one in 45 minutes. I've never had a class take more than 90 minutes to come to a conclusion on that. And I've never had a class not come up with the answer. My strongest class did it in about 20 minutes. My weakest class, like 85 minutes. So again, that's well within the range of what I can live with. And then I have them write up their answer. You can do it in a handwritten page. My students mostly handwrite their papers. I think composing mathematical papers on a computer, if you're not going to use tech, it's really hard. And trying to get don't try and make your students learn tech. Just have them handwrite it. It's easier. Okay, so oddly, I've had much better success with questions in pure math than I have with applied mathematics questions. The students seem more willing to play with something that is obviously pointless than if you have a sort of like ruse of pointfulness around it. If it's just playful, the puzzle is enough. In fact, in teaching pre-calculus this last year, once in the year did I have a student say, why do we have to learn this? It was about inverse functions, and I'll tell that story in a minute. Okay, one of my favorite problems to give students is asking them how many numbers less than 3,943,830 are relatively prime to 3,943,830. So I guess relative primality got one day in seventh grade, maybe. So the students are always perplexed when it comes back. I introduce that one on the heels of the students messing around. They read some Euler and then mess around with how many unique proper fractions have a denominator less than a given number. We goof around with that for a day or two. I make them read. Euler wrote a letter about it, and we read his letter, and then we play with that, and they go up to the board, and it's like if it's 4, you'd get what, like a half, a third, 2/3, and you're out. That's it, 3. So if your denominator is less than 4, you only get 3 unique proper fractions. What about for 3.9 million? So mostly what the students do is they start to reason inductively and by analogy. They're usually suspicious that there's some sort of relationship between the two things, like, wait, you're giving us this question after this weird thing from Euler. Like, are these connected? Half the students say, like, no, it's a ruse. There's no connection. He's just doing this to trick us. Half the students say, like, they have to be connected. What I like about that question is that it affords all the students an opportunity to do useful work. Even if you're a really bad mathematician, you can do a lot of checking other people's answers, seeing whether their pattern holds up to particular scrutiny. The students usually divide and conquer. Some students go up to the board. Some students work at their tables. Some students have calculators. Some students are reasoning. You see a real diversity in the sort of mathematical work that the students do. Eventually, they decide that there is some pattern to this question. Usually, by day three, they've determined, well, they've figured out, okay, so it's called Euler's totient function. It's symbolized phi. It's this lovely little function that's a lot of fun. When they have sort of discovered it, I tell them, like, by the way, this is Euler's totient function, and there's always a great groan of, like, no, we thought this was new. Like, we're so distraught that people have thought of this before. Like, well, yeah, you're young. Keep running with it. I think we found one new thing in all my years teaching. Which is pretty good for 5 years of doing this. So once they discover the function, they usually work out that it's multiplicative, so I can contrast that with logarithms later. It's this, and eventually they figure out that you can actually do that question really without a calculator even. And the students figure that out, and they're very happy with it. This year I had two students who said, like, look, there's a pattern to Euler's totient function. You wouldn't have told us about this thing if there weren't a pattern to it. They said, we're going to write you the paper explaining the pattern in Euler's totient function. And I said, A, that's not a real assignment in this class. B, I'm totally not, I'll read it, but I'm not going to grade it if you write that. And C, it is totally, and I quote myself, it is absolutely your funeral if you try and write this paper. The students were like, whatever, fine, and went off to write that. They both turned in like 6 or 7 page papers that were good in parts and then sort of descended into madness at the end, as you'll see why in a minute. But they desperately wanted there to be a pattern and structure. So for me, that's a real win, even though it turns out that there's not. So good problems don't need to be real world, to be compelling to students. They just need to be puzzling and interesting and prompt curiosity. It matters much more, too, that they afford some hope of solution and that they be given at the kairos, at the critical moment. There's a time when problems are too easy and a time when problems are too hard, and a lot of our job as math teachers is reading our students and deciding, like, now's the time to hit them with this one. This is the critical moment for this problem. Let's do it. In passing, I miss both ways on that all the time. This is something that takes practice to do well, and I'm still sort of young at it. Okay. You can make applied math problems work well. So Joseph, right, he's upset that we're having to learn about inverse functions. He says, look, why do we have to learn about inverse functions? I myself do not know why inverse functions are in the pre-calculus curriculum. I don't know, they're in pre-calculus. That's when you do inverse functions. Like, why wouldn't you do them then? And he said, like, well, where do they go? What are they for? I said, I don't really know what inverse functions are for. So I said, oh, I'll get back to you in a couple of days. And so I read and thought about it and eventually realized, like, oh, no, wait, there is something cool about inverse functions. All of internet security, every time you transmit something securely on the internet, every time you buy something, every time you send an iMessage, your computer is doing a bunch of work with inverse functions. So it turns out that if you multiply 23 by 47, if I said, like, okay, you have 2 minutes, multiply by 23 by 47, how many of you think, like, okay, sure, I can do that? So what's the inverse of multiplication? It's factoring. If I said, you've got 60 seconds, tell me all the prime factors of 1,081, go. Easier or harder than the multiplication? It's going to be harder, right? And those are pretty small numbers. If you had sort of a 800-digit long number and said, what are the prime factors of this? Oh, and by the way, there's only two. It's really hard to invert those things. So we snagged Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman's really seminal paper on public key cryptography. It's only about 8 pages long, and the math is accessible to high schoolers. It's hard. I didn't know what I was getting into when I made the kids read this. I said, well, we're going to read this paper tonight. So I sent them home with it, and they made it, I think, like 8 sentences into it and came back with 15 or 20 questions. And we started to chew our way through it. In passing, there's another unit that I shortchanged to make room for this. So we chewed through it. We talked a lot about modular arithmetic. Joseph declared once we had worked through sort of the formula for how to encrypt a message with RSA, like, I want to actually do this by hand. And I was like, oh, no. So we chose hello and tried to encrypt that using a very weak RSA, but using the paper, right, using the math in the paper. And eventually we produced this little ciphertext that was 5 letters long and then gave it to the other half of the class, and they went on to decipher it and came up with hello, and everybody was really excited that we had done this thing by hand that your computers do like 10 billion times a second. But it was powerful for them to see that something they use every day has really profound mathematics underlying it that they can understand. That was really powerful to Joseph. So it took us a week, right? I burned a week of pre-calculus on that. Again, that's a trade-off that I'm fundamentally comfortable with, to give the students great texts and let them mess with it. Okay, just like a literature or history class, what really matters isn't always the particular text, it's that the text be a great one. On your handout, I have a list of sample problems. These are some problems that have worked pretty well with different ages of students. So you can see, I think the first one is the one I talked about with the rectangular prism thing. These are some of the problems that have worked really well. I'm especially fond of the last one. If working with your students, I don't have enough, I want more. If you find problems that work well with your students, I would love it if we could collaboratively share these in some way. I have a longer list that wouldn't fit on this handout. If you're interested in I have a specific sequences of problems that I run through with my students. If you'd like it, shoot me an email, and I'll happily pass it along. Along with sort of a half-baked supporting material to go with it that may or may not make total sense yet. Okay, so you find good texts. Part two, you gotta have the kids discuss well. I now incorporate the entirety of Chris Schleck's talk by reference. Like, everything he said about the humanities, do that in your math classroom. In passing, that is usually wildly countercultural for your students, right? The thought that I'm going to come into math classroom and discuss, and not discuss in the sort of guess what the teacher's thinking Socratic way that Chris Schleck described, but actually discuss with one another. That's weird and countercultural for students. So much of your job as a math teacher is actually subverting and replacing their cultural expectations about what it means to be a mathematician. They've been trained that being a mathematician means doing these particular things, and your job is to swing a wrecking ball to that and replace them with different ones. So here's some things students walk into my classroom believing. They usually walk into my classroom believing that authority is the source of mathematical truth and that the authority is fundamentally their textbook. It's perplexing to them to have problems where there is no hope of getting an answer from any authority, right? Here's this question. There's no book to look in. There's no examples. There's nothing. The refrain I use with them is that the goal of discussion is first to convince yourself, then to convince your peers, and then to convince your teacher. That's the sequence. Convince yourself you know what you're talking about, convince the people next to you, and then all of you try and convince me. I don't let them stop the discussion until they've convinced me, right? This isn't just sort of stir the pot of your own ignorance and say whatever. At the end of it, you have to convince me that you know what you're talking about. I have a pile of funny stories about that. On more than one occasion, I have told students, your answer is definitely wrong. It cannot be done that way. And then they're like, okay, but, I've been like, oh, no, your answer's right. I repent. And I think that's really good for the students to see, too, that like them, I am a mathematician, and I am learning and growing as a mathematician. Okay, so that's countercultural. The central image I use when I talk to my students about how to form mathematical community is the body of Christ, right? As St. Paul writes in his letter to the Corinthians, there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit, varieties of service, but the same Lord, and varieties of activities, but it's the same God who empowers them all and everyone. To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Each student in the classroom has gifts that will allow them to contribute to the common understanding and common good. As a teacher, you have both a positive role and a negative role in allowing those gifts in your students to come forth in a math discussion. So first, the positive role. Okay, setting the physical tone of the classroom is really, really important. The physicality of the classroom matters. When we start a discussion, I actively cede control of the whole whiteboard to the students. I put all the markers down on a table in front of the room and say, the whiteboard is now yours. I'm not writing anything. I usually sit in a student seat and I tell them explicitly, there's no more raising your hand to get up and move around the room. The room is yours. Use it well, use it how you will. I'm just gonna sit here. My goal is to convince them that once we make this transition, I'm not leading the class anymore. I might be a participant in the class, but I'm not leading it. They're leading it, and the responsibility is on them to lead it well. If they forget that I'm in the room, it's gone perfectly. Sometimes that happens, not always. Usually they'll look at me and be like, are we doing the right thing? And I'm like, keep working. Okay. Students typically walk into my class believing that the way to succeed in discussion is by saying something that is new, something that is true, and something that is clever. That's how you do well in discussions, is you like wait for your moment to jump in and say this new, clever, brilliant thing. My job is to convince them that there are many, many, many more ways to successfully contribute to a discussion in mathematics. On the first day of class, I give my students a handout. It's one of the ones you've got, I think, talking about mathematics. And a big part of it is I want to outline for them the idea that there are many different ways to contribute to a mathematical discussion. One of the most valuable is throwing up your hand and saying, like, totally lost, like, no idea what's going on or why. That forces the class to slow down, to consolidate its thoughts, to put things together. On the other hand, look, even in a room of grown-ups, that's a socially scary thing to do, right? To say, like, look, I got no idea what's going on here. What I zoned out. What happened? Or maybe I'm trying my best to follow this and I can't. How much scarier is it for teenagers to do that with their friends, right? That's tough. So I make sure that when students do that, I positively reinforce it. I encourage them and say, you've done a really valuable service to the whole class by making us stop and consolidate here. You have to set a sort of cultural expectation that those participations are valued. If you give kids the handout, and then in class, the only thing you ever praise is when students say something new, true, and clever, you've essentially said to the students, A, I'm a liar, and B, I really only value clever things. That's it. You don't want to say that. So that handout starts a discussion with my kids about how to have good math discussions, and that's something we actually continue throughout the year. Almost all of the things that I say during our math discussions are comments on the discussion, not on the math. So I'm a big fan. I've trained my students that they can be discussing something and I can declare pause, which means I want them to stop their discussion because I want us to talk about the dynamic of what's going on and why. So sometimes I'll say something like, all right, pause. I have literally no idea what's going on the board right now. Like, do any of you know what's going on the board? And then they'll be like, no, we're pretty lost too. Like, okay, fair enough. Unpause, like, go back to it. And then hopefully they fix whatever crazy thing's going on the board. When they label four totally distinct line segments all X, I'm like, oh, like, no, you can't do that. Okay. Conversely, sometimes you have a student who just gets it, right? Who you think, like, I've got this great 90-minute problem, and like 6 minutes into it, you see in their eyes, like, oh no, they know how to do this. And usually I'll restrict them in some ways. I'll tell them, all right, look, Chris, you're way out ahead on this one. From now on, A, you're not allowed to touch the whiteboard, and B, you're only allowed to ask questions. Your goal is to get everybody else to understand this as well as you do. Go. And I think that's really valuable to the whole class, because they benefit from Chris's knowledge and insight. But it's also really beneficial to Chris, too, because he has to learn how to articulate it in a way that all of his peers, some of whom are really bad at math, will understand and internalize and make sense of. But again, it's not something I do, right? I say, Chris, you got to do this. You got to make this make sense for the class. And he can. Sometimes a student's disengaged. In my pre-calculus class, I had a student this year, Nick, who would often zone out for 15 minutes at a time. And the first couple of times he did this, I was like, oh no, Nick's zoning out for too long. Like, I should do something about this. And I would sit next to him, and what I discovered was someone had said something in passing earlier in the discussion that Nick found interesting, and he was running it to ground. Like, I'm gonna follow this as far as I can and see if it's a useful path. And then at the end of the 15 minutes, he would report back like, FYI, the thing you guys said 15 minutes ago turns out to be a bad idea. Like, just so you know. So it turned out that he wasn't disengaged, he was contributing in a different way. Now, I've also had students who are genuinely disengaged, and I sort of gently poke them and say, like, remember, you're going to write a paper about this. So, like, oh, it's easier if you know what's going on. And usually that gets them to throw up their hand and say, like, I'm lost. What do we do? And then we get to consolidate in a nice and useful way. Okay, so you have a You have a positive role to play in encouraging students in good habits of discussion. You also have a negative role to play. Once you've fostered a good working culture, you can destroy it really easily. Really easily. I've done all of these things too. If the students believe even for a minute that you will do the thinking for them, they're out. They will not do the thinking. They must never, ever believe that you will do the work for them. Because if they think the easiest path to getting to the answer is weaseling it out of you, they're sure going to do that instead of thinking about the math. So you have to be steadfast and obdurate in not helping them, which is hard. I mean, it's a weird instinct for a math teacher, like, don't help your students. But it's really valuable. And you've got to be patient with them. I've had students call my bluff. The longest I've ever had a math class sit silent was about 20 minutes. And I just sat there too, looking at the problem. Like, I'm thinking about it. Like, man, they're just sitting there. They were waiting for me to do something. And I was like, no, here's the problem. Like, you got to do it. After about 20 minutes, I said, just FYI. Like, however much you talk, the paper on this is due on Monday. And then they said, like, I see. Like, okay, I guess we'll talk about this. But seriously, though, like, you can't do the math for them. It's really hard to not do the math for your students, especially when they're stuck, especially when they're doing something that you know is wrong, and you know why it's wrong, and you can fix it. Like, no, you just have to sit there and let them do the wrong thing until they figure out why it's wrong. On the other hand, if they never figure out it's wrong, then maybe you gotta say, like, have you thought about this? Dire emergency, though. If students believe that you only care about the ideas of the best mathematician in the room, well, then you've just replaced you, the teacher, with the best student mathematician. So you've got to make it really clear that you value the mathematical ideas of all the students in the room. In that same class where Chris was often 30 or 40 minutes ahead of the class, he routinely lost mathematical arguments with his peers because he had made some sort of goofy mistake earlier in the problem. And his peers, some of whom were much weaker mathematicians, would be like, in step three, you did this bad thing, and like, no. And then he would realize, like, whoops, I was wrong. The most important one. If students believe that their peers will think less of them for venturing forth ideas, they will not talk. This is probably the most important. I mercilessly destroy any cutting down of students, even when they venture really bad ideas. The students have to learn how to argue against bad ideas without being cruel to their classmates. It's hard, it takes practice, it takes trust. But that's one where if I think a student has said something hurtful in a mathematical, it's an instant pause and we're going to talk about that and fix it. Because if students get the hint that like, I have this idea, but it might be wrong and this kid's going to make fun of me for being wrong, they just won't talk. So that's one where you have to be really pretty hard and keep them from doing that. They have to trust one another as mathematicians, and the culture of the classroom really, I don't think this can work if the culture of the classroom is not one of brotherhood and sisterhood founded in the love of Christ. That's the sine qua non of this. Okay, so what do mathematicians make? We've talked about the analysis, about the logic. What do they produce? Well, if you look at a modern curriculum, what they produce are numbers inside boxes. But G.H. Hardy says that fundamentally what mathematicians produce is art, and the medium they use is patterns in idea. That's what my students do. How do they communicate that? They write to one another. Lots of mathematics has been transacted in letters written from one mathematician to another. And that's fundamentally how I assess the students on their discussion. I make them write a paper, individually, right? We discuss together, we write individually. It is mind-boggling and terrifying to the students the first time it happens. When I say, and now you get to write a paper about this, they're like, that's not what you do in math. So we write the first one together, in class, on the board, sentence by sentence, talking through each sentence and why it's there. We gradually weave them together into a cogent explanation. I give the students a pattern, and I also give them model papers that I've written. Usually I give them the model paper. Once they finish writing a paper and turn it in, I give them a model paper, and then we argue about whether or not my model paper is better than theirs. It's a lot of fun. Sometimes I lose. Sometimes I win. There's an enormous continuity between the papers we write in math and the papers they write in literature and history. You've got a question. You've got a thesis. You've got arguments supporting it. That's it. In history, your evidence might be citations from a textbook. In math, your evidence is going to be figures in algebra and geometry, right? It's going to be mathematical argument. I insist on drafts from my students. I mark them up, I return them. I have a list of common errors that students make that I'm pretty merciless about rooting out. The worst of them is when students start using a letter without having explained what that letter represents. It's mind-boggling. They'll just drop P into a paper, and you're like, what is P? Like, nowhere have you mentioned this. And then six paragraphs later, they'll be like, let P be this thing. And you're like, ah, like, you can't use it before you define it. We get to talk about audience, right? So 7th graders write differently than 10th and 11th graders. If you're a 7th grader and you're solving 3x plus 1 equals 7, I want to see that you know how to do that. If you're a 10th grader and you need to know, just say what it is, right? You don't need to show me that algebra. I know that you know that. It's a different audience. So gradually, the students build up a collection of papers that they've written solving good hard math problems. And that's something I think valuable for them to reflect on later. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the nuts and bolts of it. That's the structure of how we teach math as one of our humanities classes at Ad Fontes. It's not a math appreciation class. It's a class where you do math, and you do a lot of it. But you do it in a way that's humane, that's nourishing, and that points you towards truth. So on that note, I like numbers 2 and 12. 5 minutes. So for the last 5 minutes, turn to your neighbor, start talking about, pick one, 2 or 12, turn to your neighbor, start talking. See what sense you can make of it. I myself don't, but there might be some in the room. Does anybody have an extra handout? So turn to your neighbor, 2 and 12, what sense can you make of them? Talk to your neighbor, 2 and 12, what sense can you make? Which one are you going to think about? Two or two? Which one's two?
I also do 12.
Oh! We're still. Oh, my God.
Go for it. No, no. No, there's questions. Go to town. Which question?
This first one. I understand.
Yeah.
The
so, yeah. Maybe.
Otherwise, we're just sitting here.
Well, you could try it for some particular numbers. Yeah. Try it for some particular numbers. Try it for 3, 5, and 8. Does it matter what kind of number it is? Does it matter whether the number's even or odd? Play with it. Play with it. Look for a pattern. Okay, do you have a sense of the line I'm talking about?
Yeah. I'm not drawing on myself. You're talking about this distance, right?
Yep.
Okay.
What's that distance?
Yeah.
Which one are you guys thinking about?
I just read that one.
Isn't that great? Do you have a sense of which of where the line segment I'm curious about is? See if you can draw it. See if you can draw it. Yeah, good, good. Nice, you've got it drawn. How long do you think that is? Good, that's a good start. Putting bounds on a question is always really valuable. You know it's going to be less than one. So, yeah. Could you talk about it in terms of some of the other segments, maybe? Something to play with. Sure, yeah.
I have been a long regret of mine has been my math education.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a math teacher at all.
Okay.
What do adults do?
Okay, so there's a book called Measurement by Paul Lockhart. Start reading it.
Okay.
Slowly. Expect to read it at maybe like a page or two a day. It was a pleasure. Thanks for coming. Or if you want, I'll send you a bunch of good problems to play with. And the supporting materials for them. Shoot me an email. Yeah, I'll send you some stuff. I'm a classicist by training.
Okay.
I majored in Latin.
Yeah, I read your...
Yeah. So I wandered into this. Yeah, I wandered into it. Yeah.
Do you have examples for, like, some of the papers that...
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I have a couple with me. Oh, nice, nice, nice.
No, this is fun.
Yes, yes, good, 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 good. You see it, you see it. That's why this is true. Isn't that great? How sublime is that? Can I have my bag?
With Plato, or are you just going to wrap up?
I'll wrap up in like 2 seconds. Yeah. So here's a pair of papers. Oh, yeah, sure, totally. Their names are on it, but their last names aren't, so that's probably fine. So growing math student, pretty weak, got a lot stronger. Really strong mathematician, sort of a goofy writer. But good kids both. Yeah, sure.
When you're letting them do this stuff, are you letting them use, like, the internet or a
textbook? That's a great question. Textbooks, yes. Internet, asterisk. Our school has a hard no phones, no computers policy in the classroom. If they really want to know some grammatical thing, I'll look it up for them and tell them. Yeah. Usually they can work it out together. If they can't, then yeah, I'll let them pull a textbook and go make sense of it. All right, so ladies and gentlemen, I think our time is at an end. Once you get people talking math, it's hard to get them to stop. It's secretly a lot of fun. I'll just close with this. If you have any questions, if you would like any of these materials, I'm happy to answer questions now. And if you shoot me an email, I'll send you materials on how we do this. Whether or not they'll make sense to you, I don't know. But I'll certainly send them to you because they're written for me, and I often look at my own handouts and don't know why I've done what I've done. But I'm happy to pass them along to you. I'd encourage you, play with this with your students. Yeah. So I have several. I don't have one that I really love. Yes, I have several that I can pass along to you. Essentially, what I'm concerned with is your argument clear and precise? If I can follow your argument, do I count off for spelling? Like, if you've misspelled something so badly as to make it mean something different, then, like, yeah, that's bad. But mostly, I just want to know, can you articulate this argument? And I give the kids such a specific pattern, like statement of question, statement of givens, pattern of your argument with equations and figures interspersed, attempt to check. Like, usually the kids follow that pretty well, and mostly the kids get, like, high B's and A's on their papers. If they were paying attention in the discussion. If they zone out in the discussion, like, woo, some really crazy stuff comes in. And that's why I do drafts. But yeah, if you want, I can shoot you copies of the rubrics. Yeah. To paragraph proofs? I don't know a ton about paragraph proofs, but probably pretty similar. Our geometry teacher, Susan, teaches the kids straight out of Euclid. And a lot of the language I've adopted for the papers is structured on the way Euclid writes his proofs. I don't use the same terminology with the students. I also spend a lot of time reading math papers and try and make the kids imitate those. So I give them, there's a great one called Recounting the Rationals by Kalkin and Wilf out of Penn. It's like 2 pages long and it's a lot of fun. So I give that to the kids as a model of sort of imitate this. Yeah, I don't know about paragraph proofs. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I understand I'm giving you a paper, and do you get any pushback from the parents or the students about how busy they are?
Sure. So I give a lot. Okay, so, right. Okay, question number one, how much are they worth? Essentially, they replace tests.
Okay.
So a lot. Okay. Question number two is, do I get pushback on the busyness? Okay, so I've moved essentially all of my grammatical practice into the classroom. I try and get the kids to do about 100 sort of grammatical practice exercises a week, and we do that in class. It replaces the homework.
Okay.
Yep. So the kids aren't doing 30 problems a night of homework because I think that's destructive. They're doing this instead. So it's probably a net reduction in the amount of math homework that the students are doing. But it's harder homework, I think, right? They have to think more. But volume-wise, it shrinks a little. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Bill, the obvious question as an administrator I have is,
yep.
This is all great.
Yep.
It's kind of rhetorical.
Yep.
What about the SAT? Are they using yep. the concepts that they're not doing all the drill and practice?
So, okay, so...
Well, it's very pragmatic. But...
Right. So, there is drill and there is practice. Right? As I said, I don't do this all the time. So this is 10 or 12 times during the year. There are weeks that look a lot more like a normal math class. On the other hand, this is certainly not engineered to make your students do well on the SAT. It's engineered to make them flourish as human beings. So one of the things we tell our students is, if you want to go to a competitive college, get on Khan Academy and start doing their SAT practice. And we've seen that directing kids to external resources like that puts 100 points on their SAT score and doesn't force us to shape our classroom around the standardized tests. So it's a trade-off, but one that we're comfortable with. Yeah. All right. If you ever want to talk or play math, let me know. Thank you all for listening. There you go.